views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.
Get ready for a game changer. Sarah Westall is bringing you Business Game Changers Radio. Mondays at noon Pacific, 3 Eastern, Sarah will bring you leading experts, visionaries, and newsmakers who provide the best commentary on big issues and cutting-edge innovations. Sarah's 20 years as a business executive will help you think like an entrepreneur with expertise, energy, and attitude. Now here's your host, Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall, and you're listening to Conscious Business Radio on the Transformation Talk Radio Network. Last week, I did a show about mass incarceration, and this week, I'm going to continue with that, and this is going to be youth incarceration. And it is pretty parallel to what we saw with the mass incarceration of adults, except our youth is being incarcerated at the highest level in the world. We're not second, we're first in the world at incarceration of youth. And in fact, the next highest industrialized nation is South Africa, and we're 3 times higher than them, our rate, and we're 6 to 10 times higher than other developed nations as far as locking up our children. And that is, the number is 225 per 100,000, and that's as of 2015. South Africa has 69. But there's another number that we're not seeing, and that's the 250,000 youth who are tried, sentenced, or incarcerated as adults every year across the U.S. Those numbers are not counted in the youth incarceration rate. So our rate is actually higher. And those youth are being put in adult prisons. They do not get age-level education, or very rarely do. There are a few prisons that do, but very rare. They are shark bait for sexual and physical abuse. In fact, most children at some point, pretty soon after they get put into prison, are targets of sexual and physical abuse, unless they're put into isolation, which a lot of prisons are doing that. They're putting youth into isolation to keep them safe. But that is causing our youth to have, who are in adult prisons, 36 times more likely to commit suicide than the youth that are in juvenile detention facilities. So the question is, why is the rate so high in our country? I mean, what's going on here? There's some other facts that you might want to hear. Well, maybe you don't want to hear it, but I'm going to tell you. The youth incarceration rate varies by race considerably. White males are imprisoned at 162 per 100,000. That is still quite a bit higher, 3 times higher than South Africa's youth rate just for our white males. But blacks are at 804 per 100,000. They're at 5-6 times white males. And that's at the same rate that we're incarcerating adults at. And Hispanics are at almost 300 per 100,000, so almost double that of the white males. So there is a huge race component here as well. So perhaps this data is an indicator of the deep racial tensions that exist in our country. And when you look at it, when youth are being incarcerated to this level, you could see why the adults get so angry. Now, another factor that people need to understand is that the majority of these prosecutions, incarcerations, are for nonviolent offenses. Even for the kids that are going into adult prisons, it's for nonviolent offenses. When I say majority, that's over 50% are for nonviolent. 70% for youth incarceration in juvenile detention facilities are for nonviolent crimes. Violent crimes are considered, you know, robbery with a weapon and murder and violent. There's 4 different categories of that. So a lot of the kids are going in for drugs, or they're even, some of them are going in for things that you would never get an adult for. If they run away, they'll be put into a juvenile detention facility for running away and things like that. There's a lot of issues here. So I wanted to bring back Mike Tikkanen, who is the founder of Kids at Risk Action Board, CARA, and he is a passionate advocate for abused and neglected kids for many decades. He's also the author of Invisible Children, and he's a national and international speaker on children's issues, and he's spoken at the United Nations and all over the world on these issues, including on television and on different radio shows such as this one. But he also is an amazing person. He's kind of a modern-day angel. He works with some of the hardest kids and cases. Now we are going to welcome Mike to the program. Hi, Mike. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks to be here. Thanks for having me.
I've done a show just last week. I did one on mass incarceration. And the United States has the second highest rate in the world. And we have less than 5% of the world's population, but almost 25% of the world's prisoners. And it got me looking, I learned a lot through that report we did last week. And it got me looking farther into the youth incarceration issue. And as I was doing that, I realized, you know, how dire some of that situation is. Youth incarceration in the United States is the highest in the world. And we lock up more kids than any other country. And although our rate of incarceration has dropped by over 40%, which is a positive sign, but it just tells you how much it used to be. This was since 1997. We still have approximately 225 youth in confinement per 100,000, and that's three times higher than the next highest developed country, which is South Africa. And unfortunately, we are 5 to over 10 times that of most other developed countries. So we're in a pretty significant, interesting state. Why do you think we are so much higher than other developed nations in locking up kids?
Well, you've asked the right guy that question.
Well, I know. That's why I have you here.
I am a 20-year Hennepin County volunteer guardian ad litem that works with children in child protection. And there's a direct correlation between children in child protection and children in the juvenile justice system. And, of course, juvenile justice leads to criminal justice. It's a pipeline to prison, like Marion Wright Edelman from the Children's Defense Fund says. I'm going to quote Minnesota Supreme Court Chief Justice Kathleen Blatz a few years ago when she said that the difference between that poor child and a felon is about 8 years. Now, I put a spin on that, and I say that the difference between that poor child and a preteen mother with no parenting skills, a drug problem, and a violent boyfriend is about 8 years. About a third of African-American girls have a baby before they're 20. Now, another statement Kathleen Blatz made was that 90% of the kids in juvenile justice have come through the child protection system. And what people don't understand is that there's a mental health issue in all of this. Children do not get into child protection system unless they've been traumatized. And in my experience, that trauma has lasted 3 years. The oldest child has usually been sexually abused or violently abused for 3 to 4 years. And those traumas have an impact on a person that lasts forever and make them jail bait. Really, there are so many problems with mental health in the children that I've worked with in child protection. It is so sad. Last year, 2014, our nation put, and instead of mental health services, we use Prozac, Ritalin, and Zoloft and other psychotropic medications to control behavioral problems in children. Last year, America put 20,000 1- and 2-year-old children in this nation on Prozac and other related psychotropics. 20,000 1- and 2-year-old children. Think about that.
Well, why? Why are you doing that?
Because they're violent. Because we are so troubled. Because children, actually a second statistic that's kind of telling in that same vein is that America expels 3 to 4 times more children from daycare than any other industrialized nation. Now I'm trying to bring you to the understanding of how serious trauma is to children. And while the numbers that are used for child protection in this country are 6 million to 7 million reports a year of children. That's a false number. That isn't the right number. It's 12 to 18 million children are reported to child protection every year. There's just, it's huge. It's an exponentially expanding universe where generations of abused and neglected children go on without parenting skills, without help from the community, to have families that, you know, are dysfunctional, are problematic, have mental health issues.
We're just not dealing with this properly. I know the adult incarceration, it's becoming a bipartisan issue. Both sides of the aisle, both Republicans and Democrats, are talking about it. And Hillary Clinton in particular has talked about it being, we need to change it from a mental health, you know, our prison's becoming a mental health facility. But nobody ever talks about the children. And I would think that, you know, the whole mental health issue, if you deal with it when they're children, our prison population, I mean, there's more than just this, and we can get into this, but our prison population would be different if we dealt with the mental health issues when they're children versus waiting until they're adults.
I can't tell you how many children. I've removed about 50 children from their homes as a guardian ad litem in Hennepin County over the years. And all children want to be normal. If there were more crisis nurseries, more quality daycare, if there was more of normal available to these children, they basically could parent their parent. It gets long and involved when you talk about the dynamics that we're talking about here. But children that don't get away from dysfunctional families, that aren't brought into school until 6, 7, 8 years of age. And I have had those cases where a boy was, you know, finally brought to school when he was 8 years old, finally brought to school. You know, I've had a prostituted 7-year-old. I've had really terribly abused children in this 20 years as a volunteer guardian ad litem. And the traumas visited upon them are dealt with by Prozac. And I use that as a generic term for psychotropic medications. And it doesn't help. It actually widens the problem, deepens the problem. They do not learn how to cope. They're not going to learn how to read in school. They're not going to graduate from school. And they are going to be state wards for 30, 40, 50 years. That has been my experience. And I see it happening today. Without really any recourse. And when we talk about prison populations, and believe me, there's a lot wrong with mandatory minimums. There's a lot wrong with the kingpin laws and how we lock up women for being guilty of nothing more than being in love with or afraid of the man that's going to go to prison as a drug pusher, the way the kingpin laws work. And if you rat out on deeply, you get years off your sentence. And that's why the prison population is so increased for women lately. But realistically, their children go away into foster homes, the families are disbanded. Most of the time, those women are guilty of nothing more, you know, than having been around a guy that dealt in drugs. And maybe they have a drug problem, but that surely should not destroy a family. And I've seen it again and again. States just really, we've gone prison crazy. So it's a big part of the problem.
It sure seems like we've gone prison crazy, and it's interesting to figure out why. But let me give you this statistic and see what your thoughts are on this. According to the ACLU, 250,000 youths are tried, sentenced, or incarcerated as adults every year across the United States. And this is the kind of the sad fact. The majority of them who are prosecuted are charged with nonviolent offenses. And I think the average American thinks that anyone tried as an adult who is a youth is because of a violent offense. They just assume they did some kind of murder or they assault or something, but that's just not the case. And it goes on farther to talk about youth are in extreme danger in adult facilities that are not receiving education. Of, you know, there just isn't, it's not set up for children. And other needs for children of this age. They also receive adult criminal offenses, making it difficult to get employment for the rest of their lives. So we kind of lock them into this situation. And then youth in adult facilities are also 36 times more likely to commit suicide as those in juvenile facilities. So now why, with all of these things, why are we using the adult criminal justice system for so many non-violent youth?
We went prison crazy under Clinton's administration. The numbers are fantastic. I think recidivism is close to 80%. And when you get into just the whole math of things, actually...
Well, we've gone down 40% since 97. I mean, I'm looking at these crazy numbers, and we're still down 40. It's still crazy numbers. We're still higher than everyone
compared
else.
Compared to the rest of the industrialized 40%. World, we hate people. We're a mean-spirited bunch. We've become a really mean people. We'll throw away the key. Don't let them vote. The good news is the voting rights are coming back. But I've had my head handed to me a number of times by African-American men who were trying to recover. And they, you know, they never make any money. They can't get a good job. The good news is they can vote again. No, in general, our prisons are just awful. And our jail, and it comes right down to Ferguson. It comes right down to the poor young man that was shot in St. Anthony Village or Falcon Heights here in Minnesota. He shot him 5 times, killed him. Or, you know, a taillight infraction, really. And that's going on. I mean, that sort of stuff's been going on. We know it's a racial issue. You know, actually, there's so many perspectives that you come at this from. Realistically, I'm a child protection guy. And I will tell you, and I firmly believe, that until we start taking care of the youth, the children, the babies, crisis nursery, subsidized daycare, their quality daycare, so that people actually get a chance to get over the traumas they suffer in these really toxic homes, you're going to have a prison population. The behavior problems from people with the damage that is done by trauma are very real.
Well,
they hurt people.
Well, it's kind of, yeah, putting kids in adult prisons is just not right.
No.
I mean, they're...
Actually, 5 years ago, we quit executing juveniles. They were six. Texas still executes juveniles. Texas still executes mentally challenged people. You know, there are states that don't play the game the federal government has passed these laws. So we are, when I think back on Rick Perry in the presidential debate between the Republicans some years ago, when he softened his statement about what to do with prisoners, you know, there's a whole bunch of people that want to see more executions. There's a whole bunch of people that are just outspoken, mean-spirited bunch that don't care to fix things. They just want to punish.
Well, and the executions, but I mean, let's face it, the executions aren't even, I mean, that's at least talking about violent criminals. Nonviolent offenses are the majority of 75% for kids are not violent offenses. Violent crimes are considered homicide, aggravated assault, robbery, sexual assault, but 75% of kids are nonviolent and being locked up. So that's not even, so let's talk about the mean-spirited about, you know, the death sentence. Okay, whatever. It doesn't even matter what you think about that because we're not even talking about 75% aren't even nonviolent. I mean, it's kind of like we need to get to this point where we're focused on the foundational problem of our society. Politicians aren't even talking about this issue.
Actually, I'm going to make a statement that was made to me 10 years ago by a woman who wrote a book the same time I wrote my book. And she heard... thesis was, it was a 650-page academic tome, and her thesis was that American institutions are now creating exactly what they were designed to stop. I'm going to requote from Judge Blatt, 90% of the kids in juvenile justice come from child protection. Two-thirds of the kids in juvenile justice have mental health problems. Fully 50% of those youth have multiple chronic and serious mental health problems. They go on to prison
because they've been in such awful environments. I'm sorry, go ahead. I cut you off, and that was an interesting cut.
Yeah, well, no, they go on to prison at a massive rate. And we could talk about nonviolent crimes, and that's true. Most of the stuff's drug-related at the beginning. But by the time they've gotten through a sentence, and again, recidivism is approaching 80% in this country.
Well, but we're creating criminals that might be violent, end up being violent, because they've been abused as kids and then abused by the system as well.
Well, and I want you to really focus on the mental health issue I'm trying to paint here. We really have, as a nation, over maybe 30 years, produced generation after generation after generation of abused and neglected, traumatized children. Many of them on Prozac, those that aren't getting any help. And as a practical matter, there's a lot of danger there. There's a lot of crime there. $1 to $2 trillion a year in actual cost of crime in this nation by insurance costs, depending on what year you go.
Because we really are creating criminals, right? They really are criminals. And they really are creating crime. But if we deal with the foundation problem when they're children,
well,
We can really make a difference, make a dent in this issue.
I believe that if we were to actually jump in with both feet to crisis nurseries, early childhood programs, quality daycare, things could change in a generation. They change in 5 to 10 years. These kids.
Well, for the new ones coming out, we still would have the backlog of problems, but we could stop the bleeding and stop the flow of the gushing of water, shall I say.
Yeah, well, we're getting better at pulling them out of the river, but we're throwing them in as fast as we pull them out, if not more. I've had children tug on my sleeve and ask me, when will I be normal? Those are the Prozac kids, and they know they're not normal. They feel like a freak in school. They're not happy with their lives. They don't fit into a foster home. They know that. We've got thousands and millions, really, of children that have grown up in really hard circumstances, and those that make it really are extraordinary. 80% of kids aging out of foster care lead dysfunctional lives.
Okay, what would be better detention for nonviolent offenses? I mean, instead of putting them in some kind of prison system where they're not being rehabilitated, they're not getting the mental health needs, what would be better? What could we do better for them?
Oh, you've asked a very good question of the right guy. Remember now, and I'm going to step back to the end of the Second World War, where the Europeans were devastated, and they realized that they needed to rebuild their societies. And so they treated poor families, young families, very well. And they quickly subsidized daycare, and good education, and mental health, and everything that was superior for those families. We built prisons. And today, we're paying for that. So you ask me, what could we do? Well, I'll tell you what. Anything they do is probably a good idea. Now, when they need to pay more taxes in Europe, and I've got a friend, he's actually a board member at TARA, Kids at Risk Action, who made public policy. His name's David Strand. He made public policy in Europe for 10 years when he lived there on children's issues. And he wrote a book called Nation Out of Step as a PhD thesis comparing the rest of the industrialized world to the United States as far as how it treats its children. And he tells me, and we talk about this, that when the Europeans have a tax that looks like it's kind of steep or something for children, and there might be an argument over it, they hold up a copy of that day's New York Times. And it scares people into doing the right thing. There is no other industrialized nation that incarcerates people like we do, that has the homicides that we do, the gun violence that we do. Ireland, we've lost our quality of life.
Our crimes are at the 50 years low, which is kind of, it makes it a little
It's all ridiculous in comparison to the rest of those nations. We've lost our quality of life indices across the board, from education, public safety, public health. We don't compare anymore. We used to lead. And we've given it all up so that we could be hard on people. And the racial part of this is just an obscenity to me. In Minneapolis, Minnesota, in 2001, we arrested 44% of the adult black men in the city of Minneapolis.
Oh, my gosh.
No duplicate arrests. 58% of those men went on to be rearrested for a second crime within 2 years.
Okay, well, this is the stat I have with youth. Well, that's incredible. Large disparities remain in youth confinement rates between races. White children are at 127 per 100,000, which is still twice as high as the next developed nation. So to claim that that's good, it's not. But African Americans are at 605 per 100,000. That's almost six times as much. And Latinos are at 229, which is almost two times as much. So we are really incarcerating African Americans and Latinos a lot more than white children. And white children are being done three times more than the next, industrialized nation. So white children aren't doing that great either. But the Latinos and the African Americans especially are really being treated awful. We're just not dealing with the foundation source problem.
It's embarrassing to me. And what's really embarrassing is politics is a thing. I don't care what year you pick, what race you pick, but nobody talks about children's issues. It's not on the table.
Why is it not on the table when it's such a huge, huge issue?
Years ago, 2005, I wrote a book called Invisible Children, and I don't know if you know what the Utney reader is, but to answer your question, I'm going to quote Eric Utney. I called him, and he's one of the most progressive magazines in the nation, and I love his magazine, and I don't mean to disparage him. But what he told me when I asked him about my book and publishing parts of it in his magazine, he said to me, if I published your book in my magazine, I would lose my readership. Now, that means that the subject of child abuse is not a happy subject. Nobody wants to talk about the sexual abuse of children or beating of children, that sort of thing. Half the 50 children I removed from their homes have been sexually abused. One as young as two as young as four, and the rest of them under 10. I can go on. Prostituted 7-year-olds, Prozac, Ritalin, Zoloft, the things we do to these babies is criminal in and of itself. And we don't want that conversation. I have many, many friends who volunteer in many, many areas, but nobody. It's so hard to get people to be volunteers.
Well, I had a tooth infection, or actually it was, I thought I had a cracked tooth. It wasn't an infection. I thought it was cracked. And I didn't want to have to pay for the crown. And so I ignored it for a while. It's like, it's not going to go away because I ignore it. It's kind of that same thing. It was something bad I didn't want to have to deal with, and I don't like going to the dentist. I absolutely despise going to the dentist, so I just ignored it.
That's what we're doing. That's what we've been doing for 30 years. Our prisons are full.
We will be back in a moment. We need to take a short break to have a word from our sponsors.
What is a brilliant culture, and how do we create them? Why are they important? Claudette Rowley has created a breakthrough 5-step process to help you design a culture that is authentic, innovative, and successful. Learn how to create change with Cultural Brilliance Radio, the DNA of organizational excellence, and Claudette Rowley. To learn more or work with Claudette, visit ClaudetteRowley.com.
There are so many resources out there for meditation. But did you know that Atana's Heart Earth Healing Meditation is available for you for free? Yes, that's right. You can receive this free healing meditation today from Atana Vadili. All you need to do is visit his website, atanamethod.com. That's ATANAMethod.com, and sign up. You will receive your free meditation instantly. That's atanamethod.com.
Are you ready for a game changer? Sarah Westall is bringing you Business Game Changers Radio. Sarah brings you leading experts, visionaries, and newsmakers who provide the best commentary on big issues and cutting-edge innovations. Sarah's 20 years as a business executive will help you think like an entrepreneur with expertise, energy, and attitude. Tune in to Business Game Changers Mondays at noon Pacific, 3 Eastern on TransformationTalkRadio.com.
Hey everyone, this is Dr. Pat. I am so thrilled. I've had the honor of working with Leslie Fontaine for the past year or so, and what she has created in her hit program, Sheer Alchemy, transcends what most of us get to listen to or hear in any point in time in our lives. But beyond that, Leslie is working with people all over the world, and she has created something phenomenal based on the feedback and input from the Archangels, from the Ascended Masters, from the light beings, and most importantly, from each and every one of you. So if you want to change your life, if you're ready to step into your own version of Sheer Alchemy, please give Leslie a call at 678-665-3366. And why? Because this is what you're going to be prepared to do. Be amazed, and on your part, connect with the Ascended Masters that are there to help you custom make the life that you are meant to live.
A word of caution. If you prefer the status quo and you are not interested in improving every aspect of your life, this book will trigger the shift out of you. The Truth is Funny, Shift Happens is available now. Author Colette Steffen brings the powerful knowledge and life-changing energy and empowerment from the radio airwaves to the pages of her new book. To get your copy in paperback or ebook, visit thetruthisfunny.com today.
Welcome back to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall, and we're talking to Mike Tikkanen about youth incarceration and about the mental health issues regarding youth and neglected and abused children and how that all relates to the foster care system and how we deal with youth in general in our country. And I want to let you know how you can learn more about Mike Tikkanen and reach him for either speaking engagements, to download his book, or however. You can get hold of him on my website at sarahwestall.com. I'll have links to his website. I'll have his phone number. I'll have his email. And I'll have a link to his book so you can download that as well. But let's get back to Mike Tikkanen and the youth incarceration issue now.
And, you know, in California, when the feds came in and said, you're breaking the law to the California prison system, and said, you let 50,000 people out on the street, they didn't even do a good job of picking who that was. And now we've been talking about nonviolent.
You mean they just randomly picked people?
Well, the point is, actually, that it didn't matter much. Because the education that takes place in California prisons, where there is an awful lot of privatized prison stuff, they're maladjusted people with behavioral problems with and they sent them out on a Prozac regimen, but only for a month or two. And then the thing, you know, there's just no consistency.
It's like we don't do it
there's
for
no
real.
There's no desire for people to really get better. We're just living with a bigger and bigger problem every
so
year.
We're not solving problems for real. I always call things the McDonald's drive-thru. And we're trying to deal with this like a McDonald's drive-thru. You know, it's like we have to just stop, take a breath, and deal with the situation. It's not a McDonald's drive-thru.
There's no awareness to speak of. The public itself doesn't care. The children I'm talking about have no voice in the homes they live in, the families, the courts that rule their lives. And the media, once in a while, does a story out of them, but they can't call their reporter and report. You know, get a report in the paper. So when I say that they have no coping skills, they have no real voice, and there are millions and millions and millions of them every year, it's an exponential problem. It goes on for 15, 16, 17 years, and then they just graduate into a population of juveniles with real big problems.
Well, let's talk about the money, because this country cares about money. I know we do. But it depends on what perspective you're looking at it. But incarceration is significantly more expensive than other investments we can make in our youth. 1 year of incarceration can cost upwards of $80,000. I don't know what the average is. Maybe it's $40,000. It doesn't matter. Maybe it's half that. But it can cost upwards of $80,000 depending on what you look at it. But the annual public rate for schools is approximately $10,000. Okay, so being in a school is a lot cheaper. Community programs such as Big Brother, Big Sisters, mentoring programs are about $1,000 a year, so we can get them into a mentoring program. Even seeing a mental health professional on a weekly basis, putting them in Big Brother, Big Sister, putting them in a nurturing school, get them into a mental health, you know, get them to see a mental health professional once a week is still, couple thousand, maybe it's another $10,000, which on the very, very high end. That's still a lot less expensive than putting them in prison. So why are we not doing some of the very necessary things we need to do? I mean, when you ask these administrators, is it because we just aren't having the conversation?
I'm going to come at it from two different perspectives. One is that there are people with big jobs that have been at those big jobs for a long time. They think they're doing just fine. That's one. The second one is the really big money, and I don't know if you know about the two judges that were sent to prison
in
Pennsylvania.
But is that a one-off?
That's a big deal.
Maybe you should say that. Go ahead.
The extremity of that is a one-off because they actually got paid a commission for doing very illegal things. But no, when it comes to my own experience with privatized group homes for children that need professional help and child protection, they basically hire people that they get their hands on that they don't have to pay too much. I had a kid walk home 35 miles on a 10-degree night in a T-shirt because some $8 an hour employee didn't want to talk to him. Put him outside on the back step. 14-year-old boy walked home 35 miles on a 10-degree night. He could have died. I look at these things from a pragmatic perspective. You cannot continue underfunding, under-resourcing, and I'm not blaming social workers, I'm not blaming educators, I'm not blaming the police. We're dealing with mental health problems that we are not trained to deal with. And when it comes to a $10 an hour employee or a $15 an hour employee dealing with the kid that I'm talking about, it's no wonder I couldn't handle them. So, no, we've got to stop this. The numbers are in the millions. It's exponential. The dollars are unbelievable. If we were able to do a longitudinal study and figure out why that person in prison at 60 years of age has spent 45 years, 65, you know, almost an entire life as a state ward. I've got one boy that cost the country $3 million, cost this state $3 million by the time he aged out of foster care, and that did not include the Peabody staff, the teacher he beat up, or the horrible things he did to 29 foster families in his years in child
protection. Okay, so now if we would have taken that one child and we would have given them, as soon as we knew that there was a problem, and we would have given them a better environment, we would have put them into a mental health, mental health help, like once a week, twice a week, whatever he needed to really help them get past a lot of these issues, get them into a school that can handle, you know, somebody that has a mental health problem. Do you think in that particular child's case that we could have kept, we could have saved $2 million and we could have had a healthy person re-enter
society? Let me tell you his story. He was born to a crack mother. There had been several others taken away from her. She'd always been in prison for, you know, most of her life. St. Rob, he has. But basically, mental health issues. And so he was stuck in a foster home, and the state didn't want to spend the $24 a day. So when the caregiver who was in prison at the time, a man, requested custody of him, biological father, the state didn't look to see anything. They didn't do a background check on this fellow. He was in prison for having done terrible things to teenage boys. And there was a court order forbidding him from being around boys, young boys, that the court ignored, granted him custody. And so from 4 to 7, they took this boy out of perfectly fine foster home, no mental health issues. He was a fine boy. And they gave him to this man who tied him to a bed, sexually abused him, beat him and starved him for 4 years. When I met him, he was almost 8. He had bruises on both sides of his body, completely head to foot. He was a mess. He'd been starved and tied to a bed, left alone for days in an apartment building, alone. And so I worked with him almost for 18 years, 16 years, 28 years.
So what did they do once they realized that this was the situation this boy has gone through?
They filled him full of drugs. It was awful. I was the new guardian when it happened. And as I got older and realized that these things aren't working, you know, I wasn't as smart as I am now. I mean, I got this experience by getting this experience. I realized that he never had a chance. See, to get mental health services, in the first place, if they'd have left him alone.
Well, they shouldn't have put him if they didn't want to do what they needed to do in the first place. And so he ended up going into an environment he shouldn't have gone. So it was the original decision where they put him into an environment that just, they want to put them back with their parents at all costs, almost. I mean, because that's all costs.
Well, actually, no. What they want is to get them out of foster care. The system is so underfunded. The people that run it are so sensitive to not having money for the really desperate cases.
But he was a desperate case in this case.
Not at the time. No, he was in a perfectly fine foster care home. He was a perfectly fine child.
No, but he did. They put him into a desperate situation. I mean, this guy.
By closing their eyes and not doing the research, they just basically took a gamble that things will be just fine.
Oh, they did what I did with my tooth.
And that's done more often than not.
They ignored it. Close their eyes and act like it's not there.
Well, and actually, we're talking about a couple specific things here. One of them is states do not cooperate state to state about these things. I've had that experience a number of times. If I can unload, and as a matter of fact, our governor, prior governor, used to put indigent people on a bus and send them to Nevada, send them to Florida, give them a one-way ticket. That's the kind of cooperation states have when politics gets involved. They don't care how old you are. They just don't want you here. So I'm being a little cruel, but those are true. Actually, I'm going to tell you one story that's really significant on that line. In two presidential elections ago, I found out that Governor Mitch Daniels in Indiana had redirected funding that had been directed to parents that adopted special needs children. After the adoptions were completed of 500 special needs children, Governor Mitch Daniels redirected the funding from those families into the general fund and paid bonuses to people that got rid of programs in the child protection system. I flew to Indiana and spoke with those families. It was one of the saddest visits of my life. Those people were mostly poor and lower middle class people that were doing an extraordinary job with hard, hard children to work with. And here they had the rug pulled out from under them. That's the politics of children in America. We are, if we did it here, I mean, basically, Lenny appointed, what was the name, the woman that was anti-education and grading educators for failed schools, stuff like that. That's what we do. And to me, it should be a misdemeanor, a gross misdemeanor, a crime of some kind, because the people doing the work are doing the work they can with the resources and the training that they have.
But here's our, but Mike, let's talk about it, because the amount we spend in on education is a lot. I mean, we spend a lot on it. It doesn't matter how much more we spend. It's because we're not.
And I've got a great response to that. You should know this.
Yeah.
That if children are not ready to learn, if children have these mental health issues, I don't care how much you spend on them. If they cannot manage their life, if they cannot sit quietly in a chair and deal with their peers and in school and do coping, basic coping skills, we're talking about Prozac kids.
But we're not separating. What we should do is separate that out and say, okay, here's our education expenses. Now here's our mental health and, you know, it's a different expense budget. Because if you just say, this is all education budget, then people are like, well, what the heck? Why are we spending twice as much as all the other developed countries? Well, because we're not spending twice as much on education per se. We're spending all this on dealing with our mental health issues. Well, we need to split that out and say, well, because we have, you know, 5 to 10 times the rate of children in being locked up and we have all these other problems, we need to split this out. Education's one thing. We're probably in line with other developed countries. But we got to say, okay, this is the mental health expense, and start to deal with the mental health expense on a different budget so that people understand what we're talking about. Because I agree with everybody when you say, why are we spending this on education? Why are we so bad at it? Well, it's because we're not. It's not the same issue.
What I really like to point at is I'm gonna make an analogy. You might not see it right away, but the sheriff of Minnesota threatened to sue the state here about 2 months ago, maybe a little longer, for turning their departments in half days of the Minneapolis Star. Washington County, Ramsey County, and Hennepin County sheriffs threatened to sue the state for turning their departments into mental health service providers. If you read the words said by the chief policeman in Dallas, where the shootings of the police officers just took place, he spoke to the same thing, and he said, we have to handle all this stuff. We're mental health service providers, and we carry guns, and this ain't right. And so the same thing is true for teachers. We've turned teachers into mental health service providers. And when I wrote the book 10 years ago, a woman sitting next to me at a parade, I asked a question about why she became an art teacher, and she began to weep. Because under the old child left behind, they sent all the mentally troubled kids into her classroom. No art was taught, and sure, there was fights and beatings, and she quit the same year. You can't manage, you can't expect the turnover in education, the turnover in social workers. Police stick pretty good, but that's only for a while. If we do not solve these problems, please, you know, I watched in Minneapolis here when a Somali man called the police on himself. When the police showed up, there was two officers, there were 90 feet from him, he didn't charge him, he was holding a knife, they shot him dead for holding a knife. The fear and what's, you know, growing out of the thing I'm talking about, the mental health issues I'm talking about, these are big, big things. Now, with children, the medical community is really tied in hard on this with ACEs, adverse childhood experience stuff, and the redefinition of mental health in this nation, across the world, really. And once we understand these things and we can deal with them better, then maybe educators can deal with this better. But the current definition we use and how we classify mental health issues and how we don't like to talk about it, I mean, it is overwhelming us.
Well, we can't, we have to split out the concept of education from mental health, because if you just all say it's education, then people are you're gonna fight it because it doesn't make sense. And you're not arguing about the proper issue. You gotta split it out, and then you gotta put it in context of what we're dealing with. And people need to start knowing what we're dealing with, because it's becoming at a crisis level. But you know what? Casey Foundation has given several suggestions for improving juvenile corrections. They first, which I completely agree with, they suggest using corrections facilities only for kids who commit serious violent offenses, and then invest in alternatives for incarceration for other issues. And this is some of the things they say: family-based interventions, vocational programs, mentoring programs, you know, mental health programs. And then supporting reforms to juvenile corrections that are data-driven and evidence-based. So once you identify just the violent criminals,
They are the ones that go into juvenile corrections. Make sure that you get it done right. You're doing data-driven, evidence-based. Do it for real. No more McDonald's drive-thru. And then the non-violent ones that have mental health issues, they need the support. Do other programs. They're cheaper anyways, and they're more effective. Now, why are we not doing that?
I get that to awareness. In general, the population itself doesn't know and doesn't really want to know. It's an uncomfortable subject that stems from child protection. I mean, when you get into juvenile justice, almost all those kids had rotten childhoods, had toxic homes, they've got behavioral problems, and it takes a professionalism to help them find themselves. There's actually a whole bunch of stuff I love to talk about when we get to this topic, because the centering of yoga, there's just entrepreneurial programs, Minnesota Free Art, that is national
programs. There's so many programs to help them thrive, right, and be better people and learn to be members of the community that makes everybody feel better, and it's cheaper.
Right. But again, the public itself, until there's more reporting, and thank goodness for Brandon Stahl, the Star and Tribune, and the writing that they have been doing, and nationally now there's a few more, but when Brandon started 2-3 years ago on the death of Eric Dean after 15 reports of child abuse that were ignored, he had his face chewed off and he had his arm broken, and it was just awful. 15 reports of child abuse were ignored. At that time, 4 Minnesota counties screened out 90% of the calls that came in on child abuse. Mm-hmm. And really, I mean, it was just terrible. But now, Brandon Stahl has really started to write about this stuff, and I can't give him enough kudos, because he's good. He's a great investigative journalist. And there's a few others in the nation that are starting to do this. San Jose Mercury News has done a lot of work around the drugging of foster children. About a third of the kids in foster homes are really drunk on Prozac and stuff like that. So as the public gains a little bit of knowledge, and I appreciate your show and the concept that as we get the word out to a few more people and they start to understand that this is not just a problem, it is the problem. It's why the prisons are full. It's why the schools don't work. And it's why it's not safe to go to a movie downtown on a Friday night.
Well, I think
in a lot of cities.
You know, I was doing research on mass incarceration, another thing that they do is they plea them, and I don't know, she calls them plea them and book them or something.
Oh yeah.
97% of the cases, well, what they weed out about 8%, which is just errors. But of the 100% that's left, only 3% actually go to court. 90% are just plead and booked. And so that's turned into McDonald's drive-thru as well. And it's I don't know. I don't like McDonald's drive-thrus. I actually think it's part of our culture from the standpoint, if you want to do anything in our culture, a lot of things are turned into a McDonald's. If you want to hire a lawyer, they kind of turn it into a McDonald's drive-thru situation. If you want everything, because we're trying to be so efficient, so effective. We got these processes and structures in place, which are great for so many things, but there's so many things that need a more conscious, detailed look of professionals looking at it. We can't automate and streamline everything in society to a point where it's a McDonald's drive-thru and we don't look at the real problems.
It pains me to think how long it's going to take to fix the thing you speak of, because the argument is still incarceration, punishment. We don't seem to care to fix things, make people better. We're not really invested in that. We're not going that direction. Maybe we are, but it's 5 miles an hour.
Wait, because we look soft.
Years.
We look soft and we're not tough and we're not going to take care of our issues. Well, we're not taking care. We're making our issues worse. And I think it's not about being soft. It's about being smart. We're not talking soft. I'm a pretty tough cookie, but it's about being smart.
Well, it saddens me. I mean, we've ruined a lot of lives for a lot of years that didn't need ruining. And actually, I remember a woman, friend of mine was involved in a deal where she got blamed under the kingpin laws, and her boyfriend went to prison. He was going to get 50 years, but he got it knocked down to about 20 when he ratted out on a lot of people, including her. And again, she lived with him. She never got any money out of that. And she lost her family, lost her children.
And she was a good mom. I mean, to a relative standpoint, she was, even though she was surrounded by a guy like that,
she was a decent person. She had a college education. She was a decent, law-abiding human being. Yes. And because she got tied into this nightmare, and I don't know how much she knew about what he was doing. Maybe she did, maybe she didn't. But 6 years, I think she served a 12-year sentence. And what happened was a lawyer that was traveling to his new job in Denver read the newspaper about her in a little article. And he met her, and he got her out of prison because Bill Clinton signed a pardon for her. But she was one of thousands of women that didn't get back. And I look at what I see in child protection. I'll tell you a story. I had a woman in Minnesota who had a 2-year-old and a 12-year-old girl that were molested by her boyfriend, who then ran away to another far western state.
She did. And she ran away with her kids?
He ran away so that he could avoid prosecution because there were semen samples at the site and he was going to prison. But he ran away to another state, and then he requested custody of the girls. She had to get in her 15-year-old truck, drive with the 12-year-old to go to court in that state.
Did he get custody?
That's child protection in America.
Today. What happened? Did she get to prove her point that the guy's a loser?
But the trauma for the 12-year-old, the trauma for her, and the nightmare.
That's
the
awful.
Nightmare. That man never spent a day in jail. It's that. It's all over. You said it's about money. It's about money. You get yourself a decent lawyer, you can shoot somebody. We all know that. Prosecutors, state defenders have 500 cases in child protection, maybe more. You know, and it's just a circus. There's no, you know, it saddens me. Poor people, and really, if it wasn't so racially unbalanced, you know, it'd be different. But it's racially very, very unbalanced. And I understand while a lot of African-American communities really hate child protection because it's a one-way street.
Yeah, that's awful. You don't want to get anywhere near that. So your organization, CARA, Kids at Risk Action Board, educates and works to reform abused and neglected children. We have just a few more minutes here. Can you talk about what you do and then how people can learn more about you?
Thank you. Yes. We advocate for children's issues. We support the people, programs, and policies that make life better for abused and neglected children. InvisibleChildren.org is the website. We are actually a national reporter under Real Stories. You'll see nationally report every month on child protection issues in the nation. We actually have a new page for international child protection. We need volunteers internationally to record and report for us, and so I'm always reaching out to that community. The book is online. It's an audio book. You can listen to it for free. Support of any kind for our reporting and speaking, and we love to show up and speak at public places. This is an issue that needs to get out more. We believe that once the general population has a little bit better handle on it, they will call their senators. And millennials got to learn this. Until we actually work to make government better, it's not going to get any better. There is always going to be government. And until the government understands the issues, and the only way it will is listening to the people that call it. And we don't call about child protection issues. There's no voice for children in this year's presidential race. There's no voice for children's issues in Senate races. There just isn't. So at the state rep level, if we can get some of those people to understand this, it will go a long, long way. So invisiblechildren.org, and really, belonging and volunteering at the Catholic Guardian Ad Litem, Safe Passages for Children, Prevent Child Abuse. There's a number of wonderful organizations you can actively get involved in. But supporting people that are being a voice, getting the word out, spreading these, you know, your radio show, to people so they understand the depth and scope of this problem. It's a hugely important issue.
It's probably one of the most important issues we have. I mean, children, just dealing, solving a foundational problem, something that is, you know, a source issue, is always really important. I mean, you just can't ignore it.
Pliny the Elder, 2,000 years ago, said that what we do to our children, they will do to society. It's never been more true.
Well, thank you so much, Mike, for joining us today, and I really appreciate you sharing all your knowledge.
Thank you, Sarah. I enjoyed being here.
Well, that is our show for today. I hope it was clear from what he was trying to get across that mental health is the biggest issue that we are dealing with here. I mean, there's a lot of issues that we're dealing with here, but the mental health component of this problem is really the key, and making sure that we take care of our kids when they're young before it becomes a lifetime investment that society needs to make in somebody. If we invest in them when they're little and we deal with the mental health issues when they're little, they won't be a huge, huge cost to our society year after year after year. And that's the key. I mean, if we care about taxes and we care about the cost of society, you know, it's not just about money, obviously, but if you care about money and you care about your own taxes, you should care about this. The reason I bring up money is because I don't know anyone that doesn't care about that factor. A lot of people might just care about themselves, or they really are passionate about the children's issue. But whatever spectrum you're on, everybody cares about the cost. And the cost is absolutely huge year after year after year if we don't take care of the problem when they're little. And I think that's the message for today. So I hope everyone has a wonderful day.
You've been listening to Business Game Changers with host Sarah Westall. Tune in each Monday at noon Pacific, 3 Eastern, as Sarah brings you leading experts, visionaries, and newsmakers who provide the best commentary on big issues and cutting-edge innovations. Sarah's 20 years as a business executive will help you think like an entrepreneur with expertise, energy, and attitude. Tune in Mondays at 12 noon Pacific Time and learn more about Sarah at sarahwestall.com today.